Minnesota is home to two of the most livable cities, the most beautiful natural scenery, and one of the most industrious, creative cultures in the world. In recent years, a thriving democracy of checks, balances, and an adversarial media have been replaced by political rivalries and corrupt officials, more focused on delivering for donors and interest groups than honoring the public trust. Increasingly, local media seems in lockstep with this enterprise. In the spring of 2020, this system broke down and sent shockwaves throughout the country. MinQuery is not about politics. It is about the breakdown in transparency and accountability to the public, and what can be done to bring sustainable balance back to Minnesota government.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of MinQuery. And today we're going to talk about an extremely important issue in our community, an issue about building trust, the rebuilding of trust between police and the community, how we do that, how we ensure there's accountability and professionalism in law enforcement. And we have got three really important guests to speak to that today. First, we have Michelle Gross. Hello, Michelle.
Hi there. Thank you for having me today.
Michelle is the longtime board president of Communities United Against Police Brutality. And joining Michelle today are David Beeking. Dave, good afternoon.
Great.
And as well, we have Eric Daigle. Hello, Eric. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having us, Paul.
Fantastic. Dave and Eric specifically are co-chairs of the privatization working group, and we're going to be talking about that today, of the Communities United Against Police Brutality. Val, I think it's really great that we have all these folks with us today. It's going to be a good conversation.
Absolutely. I can't wait to hear more about what you're finding.
So, Dave, I want to jump in with you because you reached out to me, I think you and Michelle, and alerted me to something I had completely missed. And that is a contract that the city entered into with the Jones Day Law Firm. And I was surprised on a number of fronts because that's an Ohio law firm. It's a very expensive law firm. Ashley's a law firm that's been extremely involved in trying to represent those who wanted to overthrow the last election, candidly. So it seemed like a really strange fit for the Minneapolis City Council and the City of Minneapolis to be contracting with Jones Day. Tell us how you first even knew this was on the horizon or that the council was considering this.
Thanks for that. And yes, I have a practice of looking at City Council agendas because you find some of the most interesting things there. And one of their committees in mid-December of last year, 2020, that is, had an item on their agenda. It's called the consent agenda. It's the, 20 items that they just all, say yes to all 20 and that's it. Nobody talks about it or whatever. That's a consent agenda. And one of the items on that consent agenda was a pro bono contract with the Jones Day Law Firm to do something with policing. It was very unspecific on the agenda about what that was about. And I frankly had never heard of Jones Day Law Firm, but I thought that sounds kind of interesting. And I looked them up and immediately began to see that, no, I don't think this is a very good fit with the people of Minneapolis. Jones Day is the fifth largest law firm in the country. It's mostly represents corporate clients, large corporate clients. And it's known for being one of the attorneys on the Trump campaign, including talking about, looking at the votes again, shall we say, of the election. So when I saw that, I thought this seems highly inappropriate. And I got that information together, put out an email to some of the people in our group, and we wrote a letter. Michelle sent a letter to the city council just before that meeting, because you only get these agendas 2 days in advance of the meeting.
Right, on
purpose. So it doesn't give the public a lot of heads up. Yes, So fortunately, I looked at it at the right time. We got everything together. We wrote in, and because we wrote in, and I'm sure it wouldn't have happened otherwise, that item was what's called pulled from the consent agenda for some discussion. And there actually was some discussion of it. And in the end, four of the 13 city council members voted against it.
So at the time they voted against it, forgive me for interrupting, but
yeah,
that debate actually, though, involved a pro bono relationship, right? At least
that initial contract. That's correct. Right. There were two contracts with Jones Day. That was the first one starting, it was passed in mid-December. The actual contract was signed on February 3rd of 21, and it covered a number of things. It covered helping with the labor negotiations with the police federation, an issue that's very important to a lot of people right now, advice on labor law and strategy. It also talked about litigation on police reform, that they would research and advise and provide trial and appellate advocacy for police reform. So instead of the ideas coming from people in our city and, you know, commissions we might set up, instead Jones Day, a firm which has little to no interest or previous experience in policing, was going to decide what types of reforms we should have, was going to investigate some other practices with labor things, including the grievance arbitrations. It was going to interpret and propose state legislation, and also work on the disability claims that are primarily
Michelle, I'll turn to you. Forgive my skepticism here, but you know, when I see a firm that is the fifth largest firm in the country that represents corporate clients saying they're going to do pro bono work, and then not that long over later, several months later, a contract comes forward that suggests $900 an hour fees to do the same work. I can't help but conclude that was the plan all along. This was never going to be a pro bono type of arrangement, I assume. I don't know what your conclusion
is. I think you have it exactly right. You know, it's a way to put one foot in the door for a plan for later. And, you know, I beyond what Dave said, and I completely, go along with what he's talking about. But beyond that, I have a lot of skepticism about other kinds of roles that they're trying to play. They have not only attorneys embedded at the city attorney's office, but they also have embedded attorneys doing work around the Office of Police Conduct Review investigations of complaints against police. And so we've got people kind of working both sides of the fence, and that really concerns me a lot. You know, it's just, is they're claiming, oh, the lawyers don't talk to each other. Yeah, give me a break, you know, I'm sorry. To me, that represents a complete piercing of the firewall that should exist between the city attorney's office and the agency, the Office of Police Conduct Review, that, you know, investigates police cases. Because, you know, the city attorney's office has an interest in defending the city against potential lawsuits. The Office of Police Conduct Review, if they sustain a complaint, could lead to a lawsuit. And so there's a lot of conflict there in my mind. I'm also very concerned about the idea that they may want to play both sides of the fence around the Department of Justice investigation. Because right now they're talking about they're going to defend the city against that Department of Justice investigation, while at the same time, they are probably going to be lobbying to become the monitors for that same investigation. So, you know, if there's a consent decree that comes out of that investigation, they're going to likely try to become the monitors for that. So I just think they're playing a very sort of nefarious role in the city, and I'm concerned about that. But frankly, you know, with all the problems with that contract coming down the road, there's other agencies or other private corporations trying to do that very same thing. So all of those things are an area of concern.
You know, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say the original contract allowed for additions to the contract. And one of the additions was for the Jones Day law firm to get all the materials together to give to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, which you recall since just weeks after the killing of George Floyd, they initiated an investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department. So Jones Day, amended the scope of the thing to include getting all those materials and submitting those to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. That really helped them get in the foot in their door, because then when the Department of Justice comes along with the investigation it's doing a pattern and practices, they step up and say, well, geez, we did all this, we got it all together. Wouldn't it make sense for us to do this interaction with the Department of Justice, which I guess in some sense it would, but it means at that point, then they decided that this wasn't going to be pro bono anymore. And the city initiated a second contract, which included, payment for their services. So they've got their fingers in all sorts of different things. And the Department of Justice investigation is, we feel, one of the best hopes that we've seen come along in 20 years. But it depends on how it's done, how much the city tries to block it, how effective the city is in blocking it. Typically, a Department of Justice investigation will lead to a report showing the types of discrimination, the types of excessive force, the types of First Amendment violations against protesters. Those kinds of things are discussed in the Department of Justice report. Then that goes to a court. And typically, unless the city says, yeah, hey, you're right, that's all true, sure, we'll just do whatever you tell us to. No, that doesn't happen. So it goes to a court, and the court orders what's called a consent decree, if people have heard of that. And that will put the city under a system where it has to make certain types of reforms, which can be very expensive. Plus also, those reforms are reforms that our city has been fighting for the 20 years of existence of Communities United Against Police Brutality. For years and years, they could have made these reforms: better discipline for police, better training, better management practices that would allow them to win an arbitration and fire bad officers, better culture, intervention training, so that, for instance, three officers don't just stand by while somebody slowly kills a person. So all of those reforms, which the city has been resisting all that time, will be stuff that probably will come through in a consent decree. So the city and its journey in working on behalf of the city has a large interest in preventing a consent decree, a strong consent decree, which does that. And then they have a strong interest, because I'm sure they'll continue to represent the city as the consent decree is in place. And in some cities, this consent decree has been hardly worth the paper it's written on. And in others, if people are watching, if people are organized, the consent decree can make really substantial changes.
Well, because it gives you something to hold them accountable to, and keeps eyes on things.
Because it becomes exactly a court order, which is enforceable through the courts. As long as you have a good consent decree to start with, and you have good monitors to hold the city's feet to the fire and to let the judge know that the city is not in compliance and so forth. Right. And so, a lot comes down to having a good consent decree in the first place, which is negotiated with the city. And Jones Day has said that they'll be part of that negotiation. And then having good monitors afterwards. And we think that they're angling to be those monitors, which of course would put them on, it's kind of like if you're talking about negotiating.
Yeah, I'm doing the right things. I'm doing what we're supposed to be doing.
Big conflict there,
So Eric, I want to get you into the conversation, because I know you're doing a lot of work on the privatization group, and I hear this, and I'm an attorney. I'm a public attorney. I've been a city attorney. I'm an assistant county attorney now. But it does strike me that most of what we're talking about here, this is for the elected officials, isn't it? Isn't it for the elected officials to negotiate this? Isn't it for the elected officials to decide these are the things that we're going to agree to? And my fear is that we've seen so often, and Val and I have talked about this on a lot of other issues, we see no transparency. So if this is privatized to Jones Day, these negotiations, are we going to see anything about this? Shouldn't we be holding our elected officials accountable and having public conversations about what should be in this consent decree? That's what I'd love to see.
Yeah. And this, Paul, thank you for asking that, because that's part of our broader framing. That's something that the Privatization of Police Accountability Working Group has been concerned about through and through, because this is not just Jones Day, as bad as this may seem, right? This is also Hillard Hines. This is also the Center for Naval Analysis. This is also Leadership for a Network World. This is also Local Progress. This is also, right, the Office of Performance and Innovation, right? Michael Bloomberg's, you know, essentially private office that operates under the city coordinator's office, and which apparently shows that there's no staff and no budget. We can't actually get this information. This is really problematic in a number of ways, because if Jones Day is claiming attorney-client privilege, they're hiding behind what should be transparent to the public, right, in all cases. And it goes right to, I think, also what Dave and Michelle, you were talking about in your analysis of Jones Day, and not to put too fine a point on this for your listeners, for your viewers, what have you, right? But the first contract from Jones Day is a pro bono contract to work on police reform. The second contract from Jones Day is a paid contract to defend itself against the reforms that the DOJ is going to implement, right? On the one hand, we're supposedly creating reform. On the other hand, we're resisting reform. And in neither case, arguably, going back to your original question, in neither case is the public actually involved. In no case are our elected officials setting up working groups, commissions, citizen councils to investigate this together, to look at this together. And I think we're particularly frustrated in the police accountability movement that folks have been doing this work locally for many years, who know the lay of the land, who've been pushing for reform, have been locked out of the process. While Jones Day, the Trump lawyers, right, outside counsel to the Trump campaign in 2016 and 2020, they get the inside track. I don't know. Doesn't look like a progressive city council to me.
There's so many pieces of this that are just so frightening. And I want to touch on the union contract to be one of them, because I'm involved in some litigation that I know you are all following. And it's a litigation involving what we believe is the abuse of what's called coaching to keep sustained violations out of the public eye. The Minneapolis Police Federation has now been allowed to intervene in that lawsuit. And I can't claim to know all of the arguments they're using, but they certainly convinced a judge that they have some standing in whether or not this coaching information is public. So the one scenario that comes to my mind is if the DOJ investigation finds that this is abused and wants to see it changed, the same attorney that are negotiating with the DOJ over that are addressing demands from the union in a lawsuit that they are essentially working with the union on to keep that same information private. I hope that all made sense, but that to me is just one of many conflicts and any of you can jump in on that.
It's you know, that thing again of everybody sitting on the same side of the table. You know, you're supposed to have two sides and have some kind of robust, you know, process, but it's actually people all sitting on the same side of the table negotiating among themselves. And you know, one of my favorite sayings is that no good thing comes out of a process that's behind closed doors. And that's exactly what we see going on here, is that an awful lot of decisions are being made. And as Eric points out, and I think very rightly, you know, the city can then make claims about attorney-client privilege and things like that for discussions that should be open to the public and that should be available and that the public should be participating in. You know, a lot of decisions are being made that that are secret and that are strategic to try to bolster the city's position And I'm very concerned about that piece. You know, it in every way, this is about precluding the public's involvement. You know, we're not allowed to know about a bunch of complaints because they send them to coaching. We're not allowed to know what kind of demands the city is working out with the Department of Justice, because that's going to be behind closed doors with their law firm. And now that's attorney-client privilege, and we can't access that data through the Data Practices Act. A lot of this is to really try to keep the city's secrets and sweep things under the rug. And I think everybody that lives in the city of Minneapolis ought to be frightened to pieces about that, really.
Well, and they'd get away with it too if it weren't for you nosy kids sticking, you know, paying attention to the nosy consent decrees. And
well, you know, I got to jump in too and say I've been concerned for years about the abuse of the attorney-client privilege, because just to give you an example, the League of Minnesota Cities handbook for local elected officials talks about the attorney-client privilege in the context of a public official. And it says that what you're supposed to do, and this is actually what the council is, should be advised, that anytime they close a meeting, it's not as simple as saying, as you probably all know, it's not as simple as saying, well, there's some confidential information here and we're allowed to close the meeting. It's, does the public's, is the legal risk to the city outweighed by the public's right to know? And I can't imagine any issue in which the public's right to know is stronger than on the issues that you are all talking about. So if sharing information about what's in a union contract or what kind of negotiation is being considered by, you know, by Jones Day, unless there's some clear legal threat, and that doesn't mean a PR threat to the mayor, right?
Right.
Or a PR threat to the council, right? Is there something bad that's legally going to happen if there's this open public discussion about this? And I would really hope that there can be some pressure brought to bear on the city council to say to the city attorney, you know what? This is our privilege. This is not the city attorney's privilege. And what's more, it's really the privilege of the city. Forgive my sermon here, but it's the privilege of the residents of the city. And we are going to waive that attorney-client privilege because it is more important here for people to hear what's going on. I hope that happens, but I've seen no tendency of that to happen in the past.
You know, the thing that strikes me in all of this is that the city sees themselves as like this little island that has to protect themselves from the community. Yeah. And we are the city, but they don't want to act like we are. They're like this little cabal or something that is protecting themselves from members of the community. I mean, it's interesting you should raise that, because we're part of a coalition that worked to develop some recommendations related to the Minneapolis Police Federation contract with the city, you know, the collective bargaining agreement. And these were 14 very sensible, common sense recommendations that would do a lot to, you know, not just improve accountability, but improve the conditions that police officers are working under. I mean, these are not like just anti-police things or anything like that at all. And they're 14 very common sense recommendations. And we brought them around to the council. You know, we're not sneaking up on anybody. We've been working on this for 3 years. And when the police federation and the city began to negotiate, those negotiating sessions are open to the public, but they don't publish them anywhere so that you can find out where they are and how you can attend, but they are open to the public. And we began to ask, where are these happening? When are they happening? We'd like to attend and things like that. And they kept putting us off and not telling us where things were until finally there was one last session scheduled for negotiations. They told us where it was. It was going to be the following Tuesday or something. And then they called us on Monday to say, nope, we're not doing this. Now it's going into mediation. And mediation is not public, unfortunately. It can be public, but the Bureau of Mediation Services Commissioner has chosen to make mediation non-public. And so we can't attend those sessions to see if our recommendations are even being brought up on the table. And they won't share with us, you know, we're in litigation right now because they refuse to share with the community even the notes that were made during negotiations and what kinds of proposals were being brought across the table. So it's this like sort of mindset that, no, you know, you people can't be part of this. You can't know what's going on. We'll tell you later after we get it all done. And that's, you know, this is what we're, and so we're in the middle of litigating. And interestingly, the Police Federation has petitioned the courts to intervene in our case as well.
The judge will make a decision on that in the next few weeks. So that'll be interesting. Yeah.
To add to what Michelle was saying too, this is of particular interest to us, the police contract, because Minneapolis for a Better Contract, our coalition, had worked with city council members for many, many, many months. I mean, probably beyond a year or two, right, on these particular reforms. And now we actually have no way of knowing whether the city council members that seem to be really open to these reforms and wanting to push for them actually did so. And that's another level of disappointment as well, too. At a city council that's been hard-pressed to do anything in terms of police reform, we really wanted them to step up to the plate. And unfortunately, the way that this unfolded there was no way to know, exactly. Hence the lawsuit.
You know, part of it is it shouldn't be this darn hard. You know, we right. you know, wrote email after email to the head of, labor relations, who negotiates the contracts for the city. You know, we wrote email after email, phone call after phone call, went to her office when she wouldn't respond, you know, almost had a sit-in at her office saying, you know, we're not leaving till you come out. You know, this is, and we're taking off from work to do all these things, right? Just so that members of the community can be part of what's going on. It shouldn't be that hard. They should want you to know what's going on, and they should welcome the community's engagement and involvement, because these are elected officials who are essentially are an extension of the community. They're not
supposed to be. They're supposed to be an extension of us. Yeah.
But it's they act like they've almost got like this little private club, and how dare you bang on the door?
Yeah.
But we spent, you know, what, how many months debating the city charter and the what I've thought, and I think you all agree, was, you know, an irresponsible push to abolish the Minneapolis Police Department, defund police, which was not only a bad idea, but it was about the worst kind of politics you could ever imagine. But we spent the last 6 months doing that. And as I listen to all of you, you're looking at real solutions. And what's so maddening to me is that for years, you know, maybe 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, we've heard the same things and they don't happen. So, you know, that we were talking about things as I was leaving, early warning systems and improving the disciplinary system. We were talking about the exact same things. Dave, you were on the Civilian Review in 2008. Right. We were having the same. We've known for years. We have a DOJ came out with recommendations. Now we have the Minnesota Department of Human Rights that has a stipulation. This isn't rocket science. It's incredibly important. But for years, we've known what to do. And yet we keep just having this kind of public drama and private non-action. It's just maddening.
That's been the case for so many years. Okay. It's been the case for so many years. It's back 7 years ago. You know, I was tired of, you know, when the city council would say, but yeah, oh yeah, you know, yes, there's a problem with the police department, but what would you do about it? I said, you know, that's not just a rhetorical question, or I'm not going to take it as a rhetorical question. We have a list of ideas, and we wrote up a flyer and presented to the city council 31 things, concrete things that the city council and the mayor could do right now. No change in, you know, our social economic system, no change in state law, not even any change in the union contract. These are things you could do right now. They've done a couple of the small ones. But we have been presenting the same things over and over again. And over 4 years ago, when Rondo became the acting chief, we sat down with him and made some proposals. And those proposals have, he's just simply dragged his feet on those. And the two things that we highlighted were both things that would have almost certainly prevented the killing of George Floyd. It's a terrible tragedy. It really is a tragedy that the city just goes on and on. and maintains the status quo. It's comfortable. You know, the city council wants to keep its head down, not get any flack, and they just do nothing. And we've had, you know, this George Floyd wasn't the first person killed by the Minneapolis Police Department. And after each one, there's talk of, oh, we've got to do this and then do that. But they never look at why it happened or do anything about it. It's back to the status quo. So this is what we see. And they throw up their hands and say, we have no power. And that was part of this latest referendum was sort of, I think, a diversion to say, oh, see, we don't have any power. We can't do anything. And now they can say, oh, it got voted down. I guess that's it's out of our hands. You know, or they talk about, you know, for 3 years, they'll talk about how the police union contract for doing something. But every 3 years, the city council unanimously approves the same wording in that contract.
Exactly. So this was the time to try to intercede with this. And they weren't, right. And they made sure the community could not have any voice in this process. And you know, and it's part, again, of the part and parcel of that privatization of keeping things behind closed doors and keeping the community out. You know, you mentioned, Paul, about this whole ridiculous process that happened about the charter amendment. You know, they put forward the charter amendment that, first of all, wouldn't have done any of the things that they claimed it was going to do. And it was poorly worded, poorly written. We did not support it. And, you know, came out against it. But they had said, oh, we're going to have a year-long conversation about public safety, blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm still waiting for that conversation to start. Mm-hmm. You know, you put us through a whole process and we can't even have the conversation because you never started it. When there's people in the community, and not just us, but other people in the community that are proposing real solutions, and yet you never adopt those solutions, you never even entertain those solutions, you block people from being able to have access to proposing those solutions even.
How do we put pressure though on, you know, the last campaign was all about either you're with Operation Safety Now or you're with the public safety, you know, you've got pro-police and anti-police, supposedly pro-reform. But it seems like there's really a unanimity among all the council members to keep all this stuff behind closed doors. So even the most outspoken of those who have said they're for reform have not opened up the process, have not done the things you've asked them to do. I think that's the most striking thing to me about this is that, and I there's no need to name names, but those who have claimed to be on the vanguard of police reform have done, it seems as though they've done nothing to open up this process and actually get these changes done.
A striking example of this is that about 2 years ago with the 2019 budget, there was quite a bit of interest there. And one of the things there was interest, it was even brought up by Council Member Johnson about the staffing and efficiency of the police department. You know, should we have one officer per squad car or two officers per squad car? What kind of calls should be responded to and in what ways? This was something we wrote up a paper, you know, short paper about what could be done. A working group was formed at the city, which was open to the public, but poorly, you know, publicized. But it had members of the community and members from the police department and 911 all sat down together and discussed some of the issues and how we could do. I mean, this wasn't ideological. This was how to do more efficient policing. And when COVID came up, they just sort of stopped meeting. And once the issue came back up again after COVID, instead of reforming that committee and continuing the rather good work that had been done there, they farmed it out to the Center for Naval Analyses. They gave a contract to this group, which is an enormous military contractor. They do a little police work on the side, but primarily Center for Naval Analyses, they're named that because they started as being a consultant to the Navy after World War II. And of course, so that they're, you know, a very military friendly outfit. And that is the group that is going to recommend what we do about staffing and efficiency. And also because if the group had been meeting with local people here, we would, even if they weren't done, have some idea of the progress that's been made. But right. Because it's the Center for Naval Analyses, they're going to provide a report at the end, and the end of it is going to come in a couple of months. We'll get that report conveniently after we pass the budget for this next year.
And so Eric, I want to let you jump back in.
Such a sample of that prioritization. Yeah.
I want you to jump back in, Eric. I know you mentioned that in your comments. And I think, haven't we also privatized and delayed the investigation of the response to the George Floyd protests as well? I'll let you jump in on that, Eric. I know Dave is also jumping.
Maybe I could actually kick that back to you, Dave. I feel like I'm not as knowledgeable about that particular component.
Yeah, Eric has been researching Jones Day. We had another person researching Hillard Heights, which was, again, another one that just showed up on the consent agenda. And if I hadn't been reading those, we still wouldn't have heard that name. Hillard Heights is a global security firm. And they were hired by the city to do an after action report on the police response to the demonstrations and you know, uprising after George Floyd was killed. Obviously, an after-action report is an important thing to do. The city dragged its feet, didn't hire them until I think February of the next year, didn't do anything on their own, just as the city has refused to do any after-action report on previous killings, Justine Damon, Jamar Clark, whichever it may be. So now the city, I guess, was pressed into, well, we have to do something. And they hired this firm. The business of this firm is responding to civil unrest. That's what they say themselves. That is their business. They help large corporations, and I love the term, high net worth individuals plan to and respond to civil unrest. You know, once I looked at this, again, I'd never heard of them, but I looked at this, I downloaded their 8-page pamphlet about how we help you respond to civil unrest. And also, it turns out a couple other cities, because we're not the only one that had demonstrations after George Floyd, a couple other cities hired Hillard Heights to do this same kind of work, but they got started in a much more timely fashion. One of those was La Mesa, California, and we have their report, the final report from Hillard Heights on La Mesa, California. Nowhere in that report does it mention injuries to protesters. It mentions some good recommendations to the police department, such as get your communications in order and figure out who's responding to what, and such things as, you know, don't shoot off tear gas when you're downwind. You know, I mean,
protect yourself. Don't worry about the other yourself. People out there.
Exactly right. Yeah. But no mention of injuries to protesters. And by just looking up some news articles in Google, we could see there were some very, very serious injuries to protesters in La Mesa.
And press, just like here.
And press, just like here. Yeah. So we expect that Hillard Heights is going to do the same kind of after action report. Basically exonerate the city, but provide some helpful suggestions as to how you can put down the people better than you did this last time. And so there is another sample where stuff that should be done here is going to be done, you know, by a very right-wing militarist firm. And in addition to the ideology, there's just the fact that no one from Hillard Heights has even been here. You know, when we say that, you know, the third precinct is at Hiawatha and Lake, they've never seen that. They don't know what Hiawatha Avenue is. I mean, we are getting outside supposed experts when we have internal experts. At least we know what's going on and what the history is here. And we would have a much different perspective. But the city wants to exonerate itself and do this. Incidentally, Hillard Heights wasn't even the low bidder.
That's right.
Wilder Foundation bid lower, and I think would have done a much, much better job based on their previous types of work, and they have experience.
So I guess we're part of the fourth estate, right, Val? At least we're trying to be, but you know, we don't quite have the distribution that the Minneapolis Star Tribune and the major networks have.
Yes.
You know, we have these conversations and it's just breathtaking to me how little media coverage there is of things.
Zero.
There probably are 10 things you've already said that if they were on page one above the fold, people would be going crazy.
Yeah.
Why is it that you cannot get, I try to stay away from establishment media or whatever you want to say. Well, you can't seem to get them to realize the gravity of these things.
You know, part of it probably is that they don't understand. They don't have the understanding of the significance of this stuff. You know, they probably see the same consent agenda and this and that we look at, but they don't understand the significance of it and they don't delve into it. You know, Dave has got an antenna like you wouldn't believe. He catches that stuff, right? And I don't think that, you know, I think you have to have an antenna and a certain level of skepticism that you probably don't develop if you're reliant on the city for them as your source of information. And so that I think is a piece of it as well. But, you know, and part of it is kind of like, this is how we do things. You know, Dave was talking about the Hillard Hines. One of the things that they did was they were going to have a community, you know, input sessions, right? They had two sessions. One was on a Thursday night at like 5:30 or something like that. And the next one was on Friday at noon. So, you know, times when people are still working typically, both of the sessions were, neither session was advertised worth a bean. You know, if I was going to do a community input session, like we did, our organization did 24 sessions in the community about the Department of Justice investigation. We did them in parks. We advertised them very broadly. We got 30 canvassers to go door to door, and they would go into a neighborhood and canvass that whole neighborhood. And then when we'd have these events, we had tons of people come out to them. So, and we'd feed everybody, tell them what's going on, get their input and things like that. And we're an all volunteer organization, you know, with a small budget. So the idea that these you know, corporations or the city can't figure out how to gather people's input is ridiculous. But
how much would the city need to pay you if you were charging $900 an hour?
What's that?
How much would the city have to pay you if you were getting $900 an hour? I'd rather have you in charge of it.
Pay me enough to make me work for them.
ain't no dollar amount.
Just gonna let me get bought off by the city. Not happening.
So Eric, is anyone doing it better? You know, I'm putting you on the spot because I know you've done a lot of research, and I was wondering if you've looked at other, if this is a trend that you see nationally, or if we are uniquely troubled by this type of privatization.
Yeah, this is something we think is part of a national trend. We're trying to get a beat on exactly to what extent it is a national trend. We're trying to get a beat on the extent to which these different cities that have been under consent decrees have been fighting against those consent decrees with corporate law firms like Jones Day, as opposed to like their own right internal city attorneys and whatnot. We're trying to figure that out, talking with other folks in the movement and everything too. But going back to your question too, Paul, about, you know, why isn't this a big media story? You know, that's why we're here today, right? Is we're starting the path to make this a bigger media story by tapping into the public lack of awareness right now about it and starting to put some pressure on media outlets as well as the folks in power right now too. And this is a really big deal because, you know, you would think that, I mean, if you're looking for a story to do, Progressive City hires right-wing Trump-aligned law firm would be, you know, your hook.
So
let's make that happen, right? Exactly, says Valerie, it writes itself. But something we're particularly concerned about is all of these conflicts of interest, right? And understanding that, you know, once you are, if you're in the city and you're afraid of your constituents and you're afraid of the public, right? That's one layer of removal. When you start hiring things out to these other agencies and right-wing law firms and everything, it's twice removed. It comes, you know, further and further. People come in or, you know, spinning their wheels, talking about police reforms, have no connection to the city. They don't know. They don't know the history of failed reforms here. They're just reinventing the same flat tire every time they come around and, you know, wasting everybody's time. That's no good. That's why the Department of Justice investigation is such a big deal. It's such a, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity to finally get some reforms that Minneapolis residents really deserve. And CUABB has collected, as Michelle started to explain, you know, over 1,400 testimonies from people in Minneapolis who've had encounters with law enforcement, who have ideas about what should be in a powerful consent decree. And the idea that the city has hired the Jones Day law firm to defend itself against its own constituents making these suggestions is appalling. And it's a conflict of interest, right? We can't have that. This is a story that's going to be coming out in the upcoming weeks. And we're building up to the petitions we're going to be getting out in our ultimate demand, which is Jones Day out of Minneapolis. No corporate takeover of our city. And that's the direction we're going in. And this is a big story.
I have a question. Do you think it's the people in our city asking for that to come in? Or do you think are we being kind of preyed on by this influence? Like, are we begging for it or are we just getting it? Like, what do you think?
I mean, our relationship to the DOJ?
You mean? The relationship to like Jones Day and like these privatization contracts, like, are we going out and seeking those as a city? Or do you think they're coming and saying, hey, we have the solution for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, we initially thought it might be the city attorney, right? Jim Router, who might have been responsible for Jones Day coming into Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Right. But we've since learned other things. I don't know if that's a sensitive topic, if we wanted to pick that up now.
Well, I think it's just to be, you know, kind of on a broad level, I do think that these outfits are looking to embed themselves in cities all over the country. And what we know about Jones Day, for example, is we learned a lot about them because they actually tried to embed themselves in the city of Chicago. They attempted to be the monitors in the Chicago consent decree. So the people in Chicago, the local community, got together and basically investigated all these people that wanted to be, all these outfits, I should say, that wanted to be monitors in Chicago. And Jones Day was one of them. And they kind of like busted them out, if you will, with that language. But, you know, and that's helped us a lot. Their research has been very helpful to us. But, you know, I do think that these kind of corporate, you know, outfits are trying to worm their way in. You know, I was sort of pretty appalled to find out that we have an entire department in the city that the city does not fund, that is funded by the Bloomington, you know, by Bloomington.
Bloomberg.
And it's called the Bloomberg Performance Improvement. Before that, we had something, Resilience Officer or something. It was fully funded by one of these other corporations. So, you know.
Rockefeller.
Rockefeller. That someday I'm going to walk into the city council chambers and there's going to be like all these corporate signs like you see in a stadium or something, you know,
right.
I'm waiting for them to give us to have naming rights to City Hall or something, you know, to sell the naming rights, because this is like this insidious effort by corporations to wend their way into our government and take control of our governments. And I think it's coming from the outside, but I think our city councils and our city staff are entirely too eager to go along with it.
Right.
So I want to ask all of you your thoughts about specific to policing. What I consider the big lie that and this is now just speaking for myself, and I don't know what parts of this you may or may not disagree with, but to me, the big lie is the police culture is irredeemable. It can't be fixed. And it doesn't matter what reforms you try, they're going to fail. In my opinion, related to that is you can't hold the elected officials responsible. This is just out of control. My view, and I admit it's biased because I work with law enforcement every day. I work with good law enforcement, you know, every day. I believe, and I know you have concerns all over the state of Minnesota, but I do believe that the Minneapolis Police Department is uniquely troubled. Not that the others aren't troubled, but that they're uniquely troubled because of this history of a lack of transparency and accountability. Because of these mechanisms that have been embedded which I would argue are not common. They are specific to Minneapolis. And so I'm just interested because I think that's so destructive, that this notion, and I'm also interested, sorry for the long question, of how you have engaged with law enforcement yourselves, because as soon as you're the part of a group called Communities United Against Police Brutality, people are going to make assumptions about you. They make assumptions that you, and I know you even said you have some law enforcement that have been involved with you. So speak to that piece. How does your work become unifying, where you can somehow bring law enforcement in? Just heard the other day, I'm going on too long now, but the Wright County Sheriff, when he didn't realize he was being taped, talking about that if what happened with the Stallings case happened, their officers would have been immediately fired. So other law enforcement is getting fed up with what they're seeing too. So sorry for such a long question, but I'd really love to have you address that.
I'll just take a very small component of it, Paul, because you ask a multifaceted question, right? But regardless of where your listeners or viewers kind of stand on, right, the kind of police reform, police abolition continuum, it was instructive to us to see city council members after George Floyd was killed stand up and say, now you see that? The MPD cannot be reformed. We've tried every reform and nothing's worked, and therefore... And we thought, how would you know?
What have you tried?
Scientifically, exactly. If you haven't tried any reform, you don't know what works. So
it's funny you should ask, you know, what have they tried? Because I did a data practice request for exactly that data, and they didn't have a damn thing to send me, frankly, you know, because they haven't tried anything. What they've tried is to keep reforms from happening. Now, one of the things, you know, you talk about is police culture. And all organizations, and it doesn't matter what the, you know, it could be a manufacturing plant, it could be a nursing unit, it can be, you know, an organization like ours, all organizations have a culture. And it is the job of the leader of that organization to manage that culture. That is job one of the leader of that organization. And it takes typically a little over a year to start to turn around the culture of an organization. But it can be done. I have been in the executive director position of a, you know, large corporate organization that I ran. I was the director. I had 473 employees. It was a 24/7, 365 operation. I had, I think, 22 managers, you know, that kind of thing. And you as the leader have to set the tone. What I have seen is either weak leadership or leadership that frankly believes that that culture is just fine as it is and refuses to take actions to address it. You know, what you get is what you either reward, what you fail to stop. You know, it's one thing to say like, okay, everybody has to be at work on time, but everybody drives in, you know, drags in at 10 minutes late and 20 minutes late and you never address it. Well, then what you've said has no meaning. So you have to actually put some meat behind what you, you know, what the culture that you're trying to drive. And what we've seen is a whole lot of talk about, you know, we want to be trusted by the community and we want to be this and that and, you know, all of this kind of stuff, but they don't actually hold people accountable to that standard. And then therefore you never achieve it. So our organization, I will tell you this, does not you know, support the position of the abolishment of police. What we know is this: people who are harmed by violent crime, by, you know, financial exploitation, or whatever the case may be, their access to the court system is by way of a law enforcement investigation. So we recognize that we cannot just say to people, well, hey, I'm so sorry that you got robbed, you know, or your house got broken into. Well, you can't go to court because, you know, we want to do some grand experiment with getting rid of the cops. You know, we recognize that. At the same time, we also recognize that the mission of police is, I call it mission creep. You know, they've been expanded into roles because we didn't have appropriate responders for a lot of things like mental health crisis or, you know, social service type issues like homelessness and things like that, you know, or even, you know, even non-moving traffic violations like plates expired or whatever. There's a whole host of things that frankly don't require a law enforcement license and don't require, you know, the skill set that law enforcement has. So we do support the idea that we have an expanded set of response options for things like mental health crisis. And particularly, I want to talk about mental health crisis in that way, because that is an area that's been uniquely problematic. People experiencing mental health crisis are 16 times more likely than any other population to be killed by police. And when you look at who's being killed by police in these encounters, more than 50% are experiencing mental health crisis. So we've got, police aren't good at that. And that's okay. We don't need to expect them to get good at that. People go to school for many years to get good at dealing with people having mental health crisis. Let's put those professionals on the scene. You know, yes, they can have police support to make the scene safe and so forth, but let's put those people as the primary responders in the 99.4 or so percent cases in which there's no element of violence or a weapon, which is most, you know, like I said, about 99.4% of mental health calls don't involve those elements at all. And we can have the right professionals free up law enforcement to address the things that their licenses actually give them the skill set to do.
You know, and I'm sure you saw the same. We have. Yeah, I'm sure you saw the same coverage I did maybe about 6 weeks ago or so. There's a story that 21 law enforcement agencies, including some of them in Anoka County where I work, have already embedded mental health workers for law enforcement. So what we see in Minneapolis, it seems to me, is all these headlines and conversations about it, but it still doesn't happen. It's another one of those things that is just so frustrating, you know, all talk and no action.
Well, we went to the legislature in the last session and got a bill passed called Travis's Law. And Travis's Law requires 911 to deflect those calls to mental health crisis response teams. And we're very lucky in the state because all 87 counties in the state have mental health crisis response teams available to them. And so we're trying to, but to get them to come to your house, if you had a family member that was in crisis, you had to know the secret magic phone number. And so what we did was we said, no, you can call 911 and avail yourself of that service. And we also worked to get some funding so that the 911 call centers could have some training on how to handle those calls. And so that the mental health crisis response teams around the state could get beefed up in their staffing because now they're going to get more calls. So we're really working on that. And while having embedded social workers is a great thing for police departments, that's actually a follow-up mode. What we want is to see them as primary responders. And we're working our way there of having those expanded response options. Police shouldn't have to do all those things that they're not comfortable doing and that they, you know, don't do well with. And instead, let's refocus law enforcement on the things they're good at and then manage that culture so that we have high quality professional law enforcement. That's what we've really been working for. And I don't know why the city doesn't want to do the things we say. I just feel like if they would just listen to the community for once in a while, we'd be in a lot better place.
It seems as though they say they want to do the things that we have a new city council taking office, I think January 3rd or 4th. As this, just about when this is going to be aired, we're going to have not only a new city council, but I believe you will have a petition ready to go, and I wanted to give you a chance to speak to that and what the petition will call for and how you hope that the new city council with a lot of new members might take some early action, which could really send a powerful message that they're going to do things differently.
Hopefully, yes. And so we are working on a petition. People will be able to avail it through our website at CUAPB.org. That's our acronym for Communities United Against Police Brutality. And they'll be able to avail it from our website. We'll have it through other links as well, put it up on our Facebook. But the main thrust of that is going to be Jones Day out of the city, because we cannot have these, you know, corporations taking over our city. And I think, you know, you talked about the $900 an hour they're going to charge to try to fight against any police reform. And that's shameful. That's truly shameful.
Dave, what do you hope to get from this petition?
Well, awareness, but also some movement from the city and, movement from the public as well, because people need to know that these conflicts of interest are outrageous, and the city council has let the enemy into the walls of the city, you could say. You know, it's a Trojan horse, whatever you want to call it. I mean, the contract says right out that you know, Jones Day will be the primary and lead law firm in representing the city and responding to the Department of Justice. We want to see a response of the city to the Department of Justice that says, please let us know what we can do and we'll do it. Not a legal response from a firm which certainly doesn't represent our interests, a firm which has so many conflicts of interest. We haven't even talked about who else they represent, but they represent, for instance, Axon, which is the new name for Taser International. Wow, are you going to think about certain reforms in the city or not? You know, so from this, we need, you know, a realization of what's the moment to say that the people need to control what happens with the police.
And so people have a chance to go online and sign that petition. Eric, you continue to do the work with the privatization task force you're a part of. Where do you see that work ending up in terms, and are you looking for a new policy? What would you like to see? Again, this new city council that has said it's a reform-minded council, what are there some more broader actions you'd like to see them happen to address this issue of privatization of public work?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, we certainly see police accountability as something the public should be in control of, right? This should not be contracted out to national corporations, should not be contracted out to private entities, right? This is a public sector and public concern. Policing is locally determined as well too. So that's really important for us to be able to return control of the police to its local provenance as it should be.
Now, you know, it seems like, Val, the answer to so many of the huge issues we have is to bring things out into the sunshine. I can't think of a more important issue to bring out into the sunshine. What more can we do here in our program, do you think? Because that's what we're going to need to keep doing.
You know, I have to tell you, I think the continued exposure. Sorry, Eric, you know.
No, absolutely.
No, it's totally right. We just have to keep talking about it and keep highlighting the work of organizations like you all, because it's so important. And thank you, Dave, for having a good antenna.
Yeah, you know, but for you.
Thank you for sending this out and hosting us for this. We really appreciate this. This is what we need in order to get the word out. We do what we can. And, you know, we appreciate the help and the interest that you have had in these issues over quite a period of time, too. So,
well, Eric and Michelle and Dave, you know, we just have tremendous respect for this is all volunteer. You've got other things you got to do. You got to pay your bills. You got, you know, you got a lot of things you got to do, and you're not getting paid for any of this. No. And you've been at it a long time, and that's all of us can do is keep pushing. But I like to believe that things never change, but when they change, they happen fast. They change fast because these changes. Right. That's what we have to hope for here.
And, you know, this is a real David and Goliath effort. It really, really is. It's the community versus big corporate America. Right. And every city that I've talked to that had consent decrees that were valid and worthwhile, there was a major battle with the city when the consent decree first came through. They would go into court and litigate to try to block the very consent decree that they themselves negotiated in order to stop those changes. And so, and it's the community that's going to be pushing up against that. So it's now we've got this, you know, fifth largest law firm in the country that's going to join with the city and they're going to be the Goliath and the community is going to be the David trying to
and city council, though, the people that we elect, the city council mayor, they have to show their face in the light of the day and not say one thing in public and then another in private. That's what because that's what I'm concerned about is in private they're talking to Jones Day, how do we get out of these things? Yeah. In public, sure, we're going to go, you know, we love what the DOJ is doing. We've already heard that, I think.
Oh yes, they've welcomed the DOJ and they welcome the Minnesota Department of Human Rights while they know darn well they're going to fight them tooth and nail to keep the status quo because that's what they have done for decades in this city.
And they may make a, you know, they may be making a fiscal argument right at some point too, that, oh, these, you know, the consent decree requirements from the DOJ, these are really expensive and everything. And, you know, pretending to be fiscally responsible, right, when it comes to resisting expensive reforms that would keep the public safer. But, you know, it's also been really fiscally reckless when it comes to subsidizing police brutality, right? So
100%.
$48 million in lawsuits and settlements in the last 3 years alone, right? Not to mention the incalculable loss of life. Mayor Fry recently transferred $29 million from the city's general fund to the city's self-insurance fund, right? Which has been depleted because of payouts for police brutality, right? I mean, come on. This is unsustainable, and not to mention the loss of money and revenue, the just unsustainable loss of human life, stolen lives. This
has got to change. You're so right. And how much of the settlements, frankly, in the Damon and Floyd cases were not solely about compensating victims,
yeah,
but about keeping information from the public. That's something I don't think ever know, is how much was that really more about making sure that we don't know certain things.
And think about what's coming down the pike. We've got about $70,000 in, $70 million rather, in anticipated litigation coming down the pike for the 89 people that were sent to the hospital in the during the uprising after George Floyd was killed. 10 people lost eyeballs, including a photojournalist. One man was killed. Those costs have yet to be paid, and yet they're doing everything they can, as you said, to keep everything under wraps. And you know, the public is just supposed to keep paying and paying and paying and having no input whatsoever on how to stop these things from happening.
Well, we want to thank all of you for your tireless work, and keep up that great work. And hopefully you'll have more and more partners moving forward. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
And thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we really appreciate your having us and talking with us and all the great questions and conversation.